When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Section 9 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Rhys. The Wonderful Pump. Not many years ago, there lived on a stony, barren New England farm a man and his wife. They were sober, honest people, working hard from early morning until dark to enable them to secure a scanty living from their poor land. Their house, a small one-storied building, stood upon the side of a steep hill, and the stones lay so thickly about it that scarce anything green could grow from the ground. At the foot of the hill, a quarter of a mile from the house by the winding path, was a small brook, and the woman was obliged to go there for water and to carry it up the hill to the house. This was a tedious task, and with the other hard work that fell to her share had made her gaunt and bent and lean. Yet she never complained, but meekly and faithfully performed her duties, doing the housework, carrying the water, and helping her husband hoe the scanty crop that grew upon the best part of their land. One day, as she walked down the path to the brook, her big shoes scattering the pebbles right and left, she noticed a large beetle lying upon its back and struggling hard with its little legs to turn over, that its feet might again touch the ground. But this it could not accomplish, so the woman, who had a kind heart, reached down and gently turned the beetle with her finger. At once it scampered from the path, and she went on to the brook. The next day, as she came for water, she was surprised to see the beetle again lying upon its back and struggling helplessly to turn. Once more the woman stopped and set him upon his feet, and then, as she stooped over the tiny creature, she heard a small voice say, "Oh, thank you! Thank you so much for saving me!" Half frightened at hearing a beetle speak in her own language, the woman started back and exclaimed, "Land sakes! Surely you can't talk like humans!" Then, recovering from her alarm, she again bent over the beetle, who answered her, "Why shouldn't I talk, if I have anything to say?" "'Cause you're a bug," replied the woman. "That is true, and you saved my life, saved me from my enemies, the sparrows. And this is the second time you have come to my assistance, so I owe you a debt of gratitude. Bugs value their lives as much as human beings, and I am a more important creature than you in your ignorance may suppose. But tell me, why do you come each day to the brook?" "For water," she answered, staring stupidly down at the talking beetle. "Isn't it hard work?" the creature inquired. "Yes, but there's no water on the hill," said she. "Then dig a well, and put a pump in it," replied the beetle. She shook her head. "My man tried it once, but there was no water," she said sadly. "Try it again," commanded the beetle, "and in return for your kindness to me, I will make this promise. If you do not get water from the well, you will get that which is more precious to you. I must go now. Do not forget. Dig a well." And then, without pausing to say good-bye, it ran swiftly away and was lost among the stones. The woman returned to the house, much perplexed by what the beetle had said, and when her husband came in from his work, she told him the whole story. The poor man thought deeply for a time, and then declared, "Wife, there may be truth in what the bug told you. There must be magic in the world yet, if a beetle can speak. And if there is such a thing as magic, we may get water from the well. The pump I bought to use in the well, which proved to be dry, is now lying in the barn. and the only expense in following the talking bug's advice will be the labor of digging the hole. Labor I am used to, so I will dig the well." Next day he set about it, and dug so far down in the ground that he could hardly reach the top to climb out again, but not a drop of water was found. "Perhaps you did not dig deep enough," his wife said, when he told her of his failure. So the following day he made a long ladder, which he put into the hole, and then he dug and dug and dug until the top of the ladder barely reached the top of the hole. But still there was no water. When the woman next went to the brook with her pail, she saw the beetle sitting upon a stone beside the path. So she stopped and said, "My husband has dug the well, but there is no water." "Did he put the pump in the well?" asked the beetle. "No," she answered. "Then do as I commanded, put in the pump. And if you do not get water, I promise you something still more precious." Saying which, the beetle swiftly slid from the stone and disappeared. The woman went back to the house and told her husband what the bug had said. "Well," replied the simple fellow, "there can be no harm in trying." So he got the pump from the barn and placed it in the well, and then he took hold of the handle and began to pump, while his wife stood by to watch what would happen. No water came, but after a few moments a gold piece dropped from the spout of the pump, and then another and another, until several handfuls of gold lay in a little heap upon the ground. The man stopped pumping then and ran to help his wife gather the gold pieces into her apron, but their hands trembled so greatly through excitement and joy that they could scarcely pick up the sparkling coins. At last she gathered them close to her bosom, and together they ran to the house, where they emptied the precious gold upon the table and counted the pieces. All were stamped with the design of the United States Mint, and were worth $5 each. Some were worn and somewhat discolored from use, while others seemed bright and new, as if they had not been much handled. When the value of the pieces was added together, they were found to be worth $300. Suddenly the woman spoke. "Husband, the beetle said truly when he declared we should get something more precious than water from the well. But run at once and take away the handle from the pump, lest anyone should pass this way and discover our secret." So the man ran to the pump and removed the handle, which he carried to the house and hid underneath the bed. They hardly slept a wink that night, lying awake to think of their good fortune and what they should do with their store of yellow gold. In all their former lives they had never possessed more than a few dollars at a time, and now the cracked teapot was nearly full of gold coins. The following day was Sunday, and they arose early and ran to see if their treasure was safe. There it lay, heaped snugly within the teapot, and they were so willing to feast their eyes upon it that it was long before the man could leave it to build the fire, or the woman to cook the breakfast. While they ate their simple meal, the woman said, "We will go to church today and return thanks for the riches that have come to us so suddenly, and I will give the pastor one of the gold pieces." "It is well enough to go to church," replied her husband, "and also to return thanks, but in the night I decided how we will spend all our money, so there will be none left for the pastor." "We can pump more," said the woman. "Perhaps, and perhaps not," he answered cautiously. "What we have we can depend upon, but whether or not there be more in the well I cannot say." "Then go and find out," she returned, "for I am anxious to give something to the pastor, who is a poor man and deserving." So the man got the pump handle from beneath the bed, and, going to the pump, fitted it in place. Then he set a large wooden bucket under the spout and began to pump. To their joy, the gold pieces soon began flowing into the pail, and, seeing it about to run over the brim, the woman brought another pail. But now the stream suddenly stopped, and the man said cheerfully, "That is enough for today, good wife. We have added greatly to our treasure, and the parson shall have his gold piece. Indeed, I think I shall also put a coin into the contribution box." Then, because the teapot would hold no more gold, the farmer emptied the pail into the wood box, covering the money with dried leaves and twigs, that no one might suspect what lay underneath. Afterward, they dressed themselves in their best clothing and started for the church, each taking a bright gold piece from the teapot as a gift to the pastor. Over the hill and down into the valley beyond they walked, feeling so gay and light-hearted that they did not mind the distance at all. At last they came to the little country church and entered just as the services began. Being proud of their wealth and of the gifts they had brought for the pastor, they could scarcely wait for the moment when the deacon passed the contribution box. But at last the time came, and the farmer held his hand high over the box and dropped the gold piece so that all the congregation could see what he had given. The woman did likewise, feeling important and happy at being able to give the good parson so much. The parson, watching from the pulpit, saw the gold drop into the box, and could hardly believe that his eyes did not deceive him. However, when the box was laid upon his desk, there were the two gold pieces, and he was so surprised that he nearly forgot his sermon. When the people were leaving the church at the close of services, the good man stopped the farmer and his wife and asked, "Where did you get so much gold?" The woman gladly told him how she had rescued the beetle, and how, in return, they had been rewarded with the wonderful pump. The pastor listened to it all gravely, and when the story was finished, he said, "According to tradition, strange things happened in this world ages ago, and now I find that strange things may also happen today. For by your tale you have found a beetle that can speak, and also has power to bestow upon you great wealth." Then he looked carefully at the gold pieces and continued, "Either this money is fairy gold, or it is genuine metal, stamped at the mint of the United States government. If it is fairy gold, it will disappear within 24 hours, and will therefore do no one any good. If it is real money, then your beetle must have robbed someone of the gold and placed it in your well. For all money belongs to someone, and if you have not earned it honestly, but have come by it in the mysterious way you mention, it was surely taken from the persons who owned it, without their consent. Where else could real money come from?" The farmer and his wife were confused by this statement, and looked guiltily at each other, for they were honest people, and wished to wrong no one.
"Then you think the beetle stole the money?" asked the woman.
"By his magic powers he probably took it from its rightful owners. Even bugs which can speak have no consciences and cannot tell the difference between right and wrong. With a desire to reward you for your kindness, the beetle took from its lawful possessors the money you pumped from the well."
"Perhaps it really is fairy gold," suggested the man. "If so, we must go to the town and spend the money before it disappears."
"That would be wrong," answered the pastor, "for then the merchants would have neither money nor goods. To give them fairy gold would be to rob them."
"What, then, shall we do?" asked the poor woman, wringing her hands with grief and disappointment.
"Go home, and wait until tomorrow. If the gold is then in your possession, it is real money and not fairy gold, but if it is real money, you must try to restore it to its rightful owners. Take also these pieces which you have given me, for I cannot accept gold that is not honestly come by."
Sadly, the poor people returned to their home, being greatly disturbed by what they had heard. Another sleepless night was passed, and on Monday morning they arose at daylight and ran to see if the gold was still visible.
"It is real money, after all," cried the man, "for not a single piece has disappeared."
When the woman went to the brook that day, she looked for the beetle, and sure enough, there he sat upon the stone.
"Are you happy now?" asked the beetle, as the woman paused before him.
"We are very unhappy," she answered, "for although you have given us much gold, our good parson says it surely belongs to someone else, and was stolen by you to reward us."
"Your parson may be a good man," returned the beetle with some indignation, "but he certainly is not overwise. Nevertheless, if you do not want the gold, I can take it from you as easily as I gave it."
"But we do want it," cried the woman fearfully. "That is," she added, "if it is honestly come by."
"It is not stolen," replied the beetle sulkily, "and now belongs to no one but yourselves. When you saved my life, I thought how I might reward you, and, knowing you to be poor, I decided gold would make you happier than anything else. You must know," he continued, "that although I appear so small and insignificant, I am really king of all the insects, and my people obey my slightest wish. Living, as they do, close to the ground, the insects often come across gold and other pieces of money which have been lost by men and have fallen into cracks or crevices, or become covered with earth or hidden by grass or weeds. Whenever my people find money in this way, they report the fact to me. But I have always let it lie, because it could be of no possible use to an insect. However, when I decided to give you gold, I knew just where to obtain it, without robbing any of your fellow creatures. Thousands of insects were at once sent by me in every direction to bring the pieces of lost gold to this hill. It cost my people several days of hard labor, as you may suppose, but by the time your husband had finished the well, the gold began to arrive from all parts of the country, and during the night my subjects dumped it all into the well.
so you may use it with a clear conscience, knowing that you wrong no one." This explanation delighted the woman, and when she returned to the house and reported to her husband what the beetle had said, he also was overjoyed. So they at once took a number of the gold pieces and went to the town to purchase provisions and clothing, and many things of which they had long stood in need. But so proud were they of their newly acquired wealth that they took no pains to conceal it. They wanted everyone to know they had money, and so it was no wonder that when some of the wicked men in the village saw the gold, they longed to possess it themselves. "If they spend this money so freely," whispered one to another, "there must be a great store of gold at their home." "That is true," was the answer. "Let us hasten there before they return, and ransack the house." So they left the village, and hurried away to the farm on the hill, where they broke down the door and turned everything topsy-turvy, until they had discovered the gold in the woodbox and the teapot. It did not take them long to make this into bundles, which they slung upon their backs and carried off, and it was probably because they were in a great hurry that they did not stop to put the house in order again. Presently the good woman and her husband came up the hill from the village with their arms full of bundles and followed by a crowd of small boys who had been hired to help carry the purchases. Then followed others, youngsters and country louts, attracted by the wealth and prodigality of the pair, who, from simple curiosity, trailed along behind like the tail of a comet, and helped swell the concourse into a triumphal procession. Last of all came Guggins, the shopkeeper, carrying with much tenderness a new silk dress, which was to be paid for when they reached the house, all the money they had taken to the village having been lavishly expended. The farmer, who had formerly been a modest man, was now so swelled with pride that he tipped the rim of his hat over his left ear, and smoked a big cigar that was fast making him ill. His wife strutted along beside him like a peacock, enjoying the full homage and respect her wealth had won from those who formerly deigned not to notice her, and glancing from time to time at the admiring procession in the rear. But, alas for their newborn pride, when they reached the farmhouse they found the door broken in, the furniture strewn in all directions, and their treasure stolen to the very last gold piece. The crowd grinned and made slighting remarks of a personal nature, and Guggins, the shopkeeper, demanded in a loud voice the money for the silk dress he had brought. Then the woman whispered to her husband to run and pump some more gold while she kept the crowd quiet, and he obeyed quickly. But after a few moments he returned with a white face to tell her the pump was dry, and not a gold piece could now be coaxed from the spout. The procession marched back to the village laughing and jeering at the farmer and his wife, who had pretended to be so rich, and some of the boys were naughty enough to throw stones at the house from the top of the hill. Mr. Guggins carried away his dress after severely scolding the woman for deceiving him, and when the couple at last found themselves alone, their pride had turned to humiliation, and their joy to bitter grief. Just before sundown the woman dried her eyes and, having resumed her ordinary attire, went to the brook for water. When she came to the flat stone she saw the king beetle sitting upon it. "The well is dry!" she cried out angrily. "Yes," answered the beetle calmly. "You have pumped from it all the gold my people could find." "But we are now ruined," said the woman, sitting down in the path, beginning to weep, "for robbers have stolen from us every penny we possessed." "I'm sorry," returned the beetle, "but it is your own fault. Had you not made so great a show of your wealth, no one would have suspected you possessed a treasure, or thought to rob you. As it is, you have merely lost the gold which others have lost before you. It will probably be lost many times more before the world comes to an end." "But what are we to do now?" she asked. "What did you do before I gave you the money?" "We worked from morning till night," said she. "Then work still remains for you," remarked the beetle composedly. "No one will ever try to rob you of that, you may be sure." And he slid from the stone and disappeared for the last time. This story should teach us to accept good fortune with humble hearts, and to use it with moderation. For, had the farmer and his wife resisted the temptation to display their wealth ostentatiously, they might have retained it to this very day. End of The Wonderful Pump. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa.
Section 10 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Reese. The Dummy That Lived. In all Fairyland there is no more mischievous a person than Tanko Mankie, the Yellow Ryl.
he flew through the city one afternoon, quite invisible to mortal eyes, but seeing everything himself, and noticed a figure of a wax lady standing behind the big plate-glass window of Mr. Floman's department store. The wax lady was beautifully dressed, and extended in her stiff left hand was a card bearing the words, "Rare bargain, this stylish costume imported from Paris, former price $20, reduced to only $19.98. This impressive announcement had drawn before the window a crowd of women shoppers who stood looking at the wax lady with critical eyes. Tanko Mankey laughed to himself the low, gurgling little laugh that always means mischief. Then he flew close to the wax figure and breathed twice upon its forehead. From that instant the dummy began to live, but so dazed and astonished was she at the unexpected sensation that she continued to stand stupidly staring at the women outside and holding out the placard as before. The reel laughed again and flew away. Anyone but Tanko Mankey would have remained to help the wax lady out of the troubles that were sure to overtake her, but this naughty elf thought it rare fun to turn the inexperienced lady loose in a cold and heartless world and leave her to shift for herself. Fortunately, it was almost 6 o'clock when the dummy first realized that she was alive, and before she had collected her new thoughts and decided what to do, a man came around and drew down all the window shades, shutting off from view the curious shoppers. Then the clerks and cashiers and floor walkers and cash girls went home, and the store was closed for the night, although the sweepers and scrubbers remained to clean the floors for the following day. The window inhabited by the wax lady was boxed in, like a little room, one small door being left at the side for the window trimmer to creep in and out of. So the scrubbers never noticed that the dummy, when left to herself, dropped the placard to the floor and sat down upon a pile of silks to wonder who she was, where she was, and how she happened to be alive. For you must consider, dear reader, that in spite of her size and her rich costume, in spite of her pink cheeks and fluffy yellow hair, the lady was very young, no older in reality than a baby born but half an hour. All she knew of the world was contained in the glimpse she had secured of the busy street facing her window. All she knew of people lay in the actions of the group of women which had stood before her on the other side of the window-pane and criticized the fit of her dress or remarked upon its stylish appearance. So she had little enough to think about, and her thoughts moved somewhat slowly. Yet one thing she really decided upon, and that was not to remain in the window and be insolently stared at by a lot of women who were not nearly so handsome or well-dressed as herself. By the time she reached this important conclusion, it was after midnight. But dim lights were burning in the big deserted store, so she crept through the door of her window and walked down the long aisles, pausing now and then to look with much curiosity at the wealth of finery confronting her on every side. When she came to the glass cases filled with trimmed hats, she remembered having seen upon the heads of the women in the street similar creations. So she selected one that suited her fancy and placed it carefully upon her yellow locks. I won't attempt to explain what instinct it was that made her glance into a nearby mirror to see if the hat was straight, but this she certainly did. It didn't correspond with her dress very well, but the poor thing was too young to have much taste in matching colors. When she reached the glove counter, she remembered that gloves were also worn by the women she had seen. She took a pair from the case and tried to fit them upon her stiff, wax-coated fingers, but the gloves were too small and ripped in the seams. Then she tried another pair, and several others as well, but hours passed before she finally succeeded in getting her hands covered with a pair of pea-green kids. Next, she selected a parasol from a large and varied assortment in the rear of the store. Not that she had any idea what it was used for, but other ladies carried such things, so she also would have one. When she again examined herself critically in the mirror, she decided her outfit was now complete, and to her inexperienced eyes there was no perceptible difference between her and the women who had stood outside the window. Whereupon she tried to leave the store, but found every door fast locked. The wax lady was in no hurry. She inherited patience from her previous existence. Just to be alive and to wear beautiful clothes was sufficient enjoyment for her at present. So she sat down upon a stool and waited quietly until daylight. When the janitor unlocked the door in the morning, the wax lady swept past him and walked with stiff but stately strides down the street. The poor fellow was so completely whuckered at seeing the well-known wax lady leave her window and march away from the store that he fell over in a heap and only saved himself from fainting by striking his funny bone against the doorstep. When he recovered his wits, she had turned the corner and disappeared. The wax lady's immature mind had reasoned that, since she had come to life, her evident duty was to mix with the world and do whatever other folks did. She could not realize how different she was from people of flesh and blood, nor did she know that she was the first dummy that had ever lived, or that she owed her unique experience to Tanko Mankey's love of mischief. So ignorance gave her a confidence in herself that she was not justly entitled to. It was yet early in the day, and the few people she met were hurrying along the streets. Many of them turned into restaurants and eating-houses, and following their example, the wax lady also entered one and sat upon a stool before a lunch-counter. "Coffee and rolls," said a shop-girl on the next stool. "Coffee and rolls," repeated the dummy, and soon the waiter placed them before her. Of course, she had no appetite, as her constitution, being mostly wood, did not require food, but she watched the shop-girl and saw her put the coffee to her mouth and drink it. Therefore the wax lady did the same, and the next instant was surprised to feel the hot liquid trickling out between her wooden ribs. The coffee also blistered her wax lips, and so disagreeable was the experience that she arose and left the restaurant, paying no attention to the demands of the waiter for 20 cents, mum. Not that she intended to defraud him, but the poor creature had no idea what he meant by 20 cents, mum. As she came out, she met the window trimmer at Floman's store. The man was rather near-sighted, but seeing something familiar in the lady's features, he politely raised his hat. The wax lady also raised her hat, thinking it the proper thing to do, and the man hurried away with a horrified face. Then a woman touched her arm and said, "Beg pardon, ma'am, but there's a price mark hanging on your dress behind." "Yes, I know," replied the wax lady, stiffly. "It was originally $20, but it's been reduced to 1998. The woman looked surprised at such indifference, and walked on. Some carriages were standing at the edge of the sidewalk, and seeing the dummy hesitate, a driver approached her and touched his cap. "Cab, ma'am?" he asked. "No," said she, misunderstanding him. "I'm wax." "Oh," he exclaimed, and looked after her wonderingly. "Here's your morning paper," yelled a newsboy. "Mine, did you say?" she asked. "Sure. Chronicle, 'Quirer, Republic, and Spatch. What'll you have?"
"What are they for?"
inquired the wax lady simply.
"Why, to read, of course. All the news, you know."
She shook her head and glanced at a paper. "It looks all speckled and mixed up," she said. "I'm afraid I can't read."
"Ever been to school?" asked the boy, becoming interested.
"No. What's school?" she inquired. The boy gave her an indignant look.
"Say," he cried, "you're just a dummy, that's what you are,"
and ran away to seek a more promising customer.
"I wonder what he means," thought the poor lady. "Am I really different in some way from all the others? I look like them, certainly, and I tried to act like them, yet that boy called me a dummy, and seemed to think I acted queerly."
This idea worried her a little, but she walked on to the corner where she noticed a streetcar stop to let some people on. The wax lady, still determined to do as others did, also boarded the car and sat down quietly in a corner. After riding a few blocks, the conductor approached her and said, "Fare, please."
"What's that?" she inquired innocently.
"Your fare," said the man impatiently. She stared at him stupidly, trying to think what he meant.
"Come, come," growled the conductor. "Either pay up or get off."
Still, she did not understand, and he grabbed her rudely by the arm and lifted her to her feet.
But when his hand came in contact with the hard wood of which her arm was made, the fellow was filled with surprise.
He stooped down and peered into her face, and, seeing it was wax instead of flesh, he gave a yell of fear and jumped from the car, running as if he had seen a ghost. At this, the other passengers also yelled and sprang from the car, fearing a collision, and the motorman, knowing something was wrong, followed suit. The wax lady, seeing the others run, jumped from the car last of all and stepped in front of another car, coming at full speed from the opposite direction. She heard cries of fear and warning on all sides, but before she understood her danger she was knocked down and dragged for half a block. When the car was brought to a stop, a policeman reached down and pulled her from under the wheels. Her dress was badly torn and soiled. Her left ear was entirely gone, and the left side of her head was caved in, but she quickly scrambled to her feet and asked for her hat. This a gentleman had already picked up, and when the policeman handed it to her and noticed the great hole in her head and the hollow place it disclosed, the poor fellow trembled so frightfully that his knees actually knocked together.
"Why, "Why, ma'am, you're killed," he gasped. "What does it mean to be killed?" asked the wax lady. The policeman shuddered and wiped the perspiration from his forehead. "You're it," he answered with a groan. The crowd that had collected were looking upon the lady wonderingly, and a middle-aged gentleman now exclaimed, "Why, she's wax!"
"Wax!" echoed the policeman.
"Certainly, she's one of those dummies they put in the windows," declared the middle-aged man. The people who had collected shouted, "You're right! That's what she is! She's a dummy!"
"Are you?"
inquired the policeman sternly. The wax lady did not reply. She began to fear she was getting into trouble, and the staring crowd seemed to embarrass her. Suddenly a bootblack attempted to solve the problem by saying,
"You guys is all wrong. Can a dummy talk? Can a dummy walk? Can a dummy live?"
"Hush," murmured the policeman. "Look here," and he pointed to the hole in the lady's head. The newsboy looked, turned pale, and whistled to himself to keep from shivering. A second policeman now arrived, and after a brief conference, it was decided to take the strange creature to headquarters. So they called a hurry-up wagon, and the damaged wax lady was helped inside and driven to the police station. There, the policeman locked her in a cell and hastened to tell Inspector Mugg their wonderful story. Inspector Mugg had just eaten a poor breakfast and was not in a pleasant mood, so he roared and stormed at the unlucky policeman, saying they were themselves dummies to bring such a fairy tale to a man of sense. He also hinted that they had been guilty of intemperance. The policeman tried to explain, but Inspector Mugg would not listen, and while they were still disputing, in rushed Mr. Floman, the owner of the department store.
"I want a dozen detectives at once, Inspector," he cried.
"What for?" demanded Mugg.
"One of the wax ladies has escaped from my store and eloped with a $19.98 costume, a $4.23 hat, a $2.19 parasol, and a 76-cent pair of gloves, and I want her arrested." While he paused for breath, the inspector glared at him in amazement.
"Is everybody going crazy at the same time?" he inquired sarcastically. "How could a wax dummy run away?"
"I don't know, but she did. When my janitor opened the door this morning, he saw her run out."
"Why didn't he stop her?" asked Mugg.
"He was too frightened, but she's stolen my property, Your Honor, and I want her arrested," declared the storekeeper.
The inspector thought for a moment.
"You wouldn't be able to prosecute her," he said, "for there's no law against dummies stealing."
Mr. Floman sighed bitterly.
"Am I to lose that $19.98 costume, and the $4.25 hat, and—"
"By no means," interrupted Inspector Mugg.
"The police of this city are ever prompt to act in defense of our worthy citizens. We have already arrested the wax lady, and she is locked up in cell number 16. You may go there and recover your property if you wish, but before you prosecute her for stealing, you'd better hunt up a law that applies to dummies."
"All I want," said Mr. Floman, "is that $19.98 costume and—"
"Come along," interrupted the policeman. "I'll take you to the cell."
But when they entered number 16, they found only a lifeless dummy lying prone upon the floor. Its wax was cracked and blistered, its head was badly damaged, and the bargain costume was dusty, soiled, and much bedraggled. For the mischief-loving Tanko Mankie had flown by and breathed once more upon the poor wax lady, and in that instant her brief life ended.
"It's just as I thought," said Inspector Mugg, leaning back in his chair contentedly. "I knew all the time the thing was a fake. It seems sometimes as though the whole world would go crazy if there wasn't some level-headed man around to bring 'em to their senses. Dummies are wood and wax, and that's all there is of 'em."
"That may be the rule," whispered the policeman to himself, "but this one were a dummy as lived."
End of The Dummy That Lived. Recording by Matthew Rees, Davenport, Iowa.
Section 11 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Rees. The King of the Polar Bears. The King of the Polar Bears lived among the icebergs in the far north country. He was old and monstrous big. He was wise and friendly to all who knew him. His body was thickly covered with long white hair that glistened like silver under the rays of the midnight sun. His claws were strong and sharp, that he might walk safely over the smooth ice or grasp and tear the fishes and seals upon which he fed. The seals were afraid when he drew near and tried to avoid him, but the gulls, both white and gray, loved him,
because he left the remnants of his feasts for them to devour. Often his subjects, the polar bears, came to him for advice when ill or in trouble, but they wisely kept away from his hunting grounds, lest they might interfere with his sport and arouse his anger. The wolves, who sometimes came as far north as the icebergs, whispered among themselves that the king of the polar bears was either a magician or under the protection of a powerful fairy, for no earthly thing seemed able to harm him. He never failed to secure plenty of food, and he grew bigger and stronger day by day and year by year. Yet the time came when this monarch of the north met man, and his wisdom failed him. He came out of his cave among the icebergs one day and saw a boat moving through the strip of water which had been uncovered by the shifting of the summer ice. In the boat were men. The great bear had never seen such creatures before, and therefore advanced toward the boat, sniffing the strange scent with aroused curiosity, and wondering whether he might take them for friends or foes, food or carrion. When the king came near the water's edge, a man stood up in the boat, and with a queer instrument made a loud bang. The polar bear felt a shock. His brain became numb. His thoughts deserted him. His great limbs shook and gave way beneath him, and his body fell heavily upon the hard ice. That was all he remembered for a time. When he awoke, he was smarting with pain on every inch of his huge bulk, for the men had cut away his hide with its glorious white hair and carried it with them to a distant ship. Above him circled thousands of his friends, the gulls, wondering if their benefactor were really dead, and it was proper to eat him. But when they saw him raise his head and groan and tremble, they knew he still lived, and one of them said to his comrades, "The wolves were right. The king is a great magician, for even men cannot kill him. But he suffers for lack of covering. Let us repay his kindness to us by each giving him as many feathers as we can spare." This idea pleased the gulls. One after another they plucked with their beaks the softest feathers from under their wings and, flying down, dropped them gently upon the body of the king of the polar bears. Then they called to him in a chorus, "Courage, friend! Our feathers are as soft and beautiful as your own shaggy hair. They will guard you from the cold winds and warm you while you sleep. Have courage, then, and live." And the king of the polar bears had courage to bear his pain, and lived, and was strong again. The feathers grew as they had grown upon the bodies of the birds, and covered him as his own hair had done. Mostly they were pure white in color, but some from the gray gulls gave his majesty a slightly mottled appearance. The rest of that summer, and all through the 6 months of night, the king left his icy cavern only to fish or catch seals for food. He felt no shame at his feathery covering, but it was still strange to him, and he avoided meeting any of his brother bears. During this period of retirement, he thought much of the men who had harmed him, and remembered the way they had made the great bang, and he decided it was best to keep away from such fierce creatures. Thus he added to his store of wisdom. When the moon fell away from the sky and the sun came to make the icebergs glitter with the gorgeous tintings of the rainbow, two of the polar bears arrived at the king's cavern to ask his advice about the hunting season. But when they saw his great body covered with feathers instead of hair, they began to laugh, and one said, "Our mighty king has become a bird. Who ever before heard of a feathered polar bear?" Then the king gave way to wrath. He advanced upon them with deep growls and stately tread, and with one blow of his monstrous paw stretched the mocker lifeless at his feet. The other ran away to his fellows and carried the news of the king's strange appearance. The result was a meeting of all the polar bears upon a broad field of ice, where they talked gravely of the remarkable change that had come upon their monarch. "He is, in reality, no longer a bear," said one, "nor can he justly be called a bird, but he is half bird and half bear, and so unfitted to remain our king." "Then who shall take his place?" asked another. "He who can fight the bird bear and overcome him," answered an aged member of the group. "Only the strongest is fit to rule our race." There was silence for a time, but at length a great bear moved to the front and said, "I will fight him. I, Woof, the strongest of our race. And I will be king of the polar bears." The others nodded assent and dispatched a messenger to the king to say he must fight the great Woof and master him or resign his sovereignty. "For a bird with feathers," added the messenger, "is no bear at all, and the king we obey must resemble the rest of us." "I wear feathers because it pleases me," growled the king. "Am I not a great magician?
But I will fight, nevertheless, and if Woof masters me, he shall be king in my stead." Then he visited his friends, the gulls, who were even then feasting upon the dead bear, and told them of the coming battle. "I shall conquer," he said proudly. "Yet my people are in the right, for only a hairy one like themselves can hope to command their obedience." The queen gull said, "I met an eagle yesterday, which had made its escape from a big city of men, and the eagle told me he had seen a monstrous polar bear skin thrown over the back of a carriage that rolled along the street. That skin must have been yours, O king, and if you wish, I will send 100 of my gulls to the city to bring it back to you." "Let them go," said the king gruffly, and the 100 gulls were soon flying rapidly southward. For 3 days they flew straight as an arrow until they came to scattered houses, to villages, and to cities. Then their search began. The gulls were brave and cunning and wise. Upon the 4th day they reached the great metropolis and hovered over the streets until a carriage rolled along with a great white bear robe thrown over the back seat. Then the birds swooped down, the whole 100 of them, and seizing the skin in their beaks, flew quickly away. They were late. The king's great battle was upon the 7th day, and they must fly swiftly to reach the polar regions by that time. Meanwhile, the bird bear was preparing for his fight. He sharpened his claws in the small crevasses of the ice. He caught a seal and tested his big yellow teeth by crunching its bones between them. And the queen gull set her band to pluming the king bear's feathers until they lay smoothly upon his body. But every day they cast anxious glances into the southern sky, watching for the 100 gulls to bring back the king's own skin. The 7th day came, and all the polar bears in that region gathered around the king's cavern. Among them was Woof, strong and confident of his success. "The bird bear's feathers will fly fast enough when I get my claws upon him," he boasted, and the others laughed and encouraged him. The king was disappointed at not having recovered his skin, but he resolved to fight bravely without it. He advanced from the opening of his cavern with a proud and kingly bearing, and when he faced his enemy he gave so terrible a growl that Woof's heart stopped beating for a moment, and he began to realize that a fight with the wise and mighty king of his race was no laughing matter. After exchanging one or two heavy blows with his foe, Woof's courage returned, and he determined to dishearten his adversary by bluster. "Come nearer, bird bear," he cried. "Come nearer that I may pluck your plumage." The defiance filled the king with rage. He ruffled his feathers as a bird does, till he appeared to be twice his actual size, and then he strode forward and struck Woof so powerful a blow that his skull crackled like an eggshell, and he fell prone upon the ground. While the assembled bears stood looking with fear and wonder at their fallen champion, the sky became darkened. 100 gulls flew down from above and dripped upon the king's body a skin covered with pure white hair that glittered in the sun like silver. And behold, the bears saw before them the well-known form of their wise and respected master, and with one accord they bowed their shaggy heads in homage to the mighty king of the polar bears. This story teaches us that true dignity and courage depend not upon outward appearance, but come rather from within. Also, that brag and bluster are poor weapons to carry into battle. End of The King of the Polar Bears. Recording by Matthew Rees, Davenport, Iowa. Section 12 of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Matthew Rees. The Mandarin and the Butterfly. A mandarin once lived in Qianghou, who was so exceedingly cross and disagreeable that everyone hated him. He snarled and stormed at every person he met, and was never known to laugh or be merry under any circumstances. Especially, he hated boys and girls, for the boys jeered at him, which aroused his wrath, and the girls made fun of him, which hurt his pride. When he had become so unpopular that no one would speak to him, the emperor heard about it and commanded him to emigrate to America. This suited the mandarin very well, but before he left China he stole the great book of magic that belonged to the wise magician Hao Cai. Then, gathering up his little store of money, he took ship for America. He settled in a city of the Middle West, and, of course, started a laundry, since that seems to be the natural vocation of every Chinaman, be he coolie or mandarin. He made no acquaintances with the other Chinamen of the town, who, when they met him and saw the red button upon his hat, knew him for a real mandarin and bowed low before him.
He put up a red and white sign, and people brought their laundry to him and got paper checks, with Chinese characters upon them in exchange, this being the only sort of character the Mandarin had left. One day, as the ugly one was ironing in his shop in the basement of 263½ Main Street, he looked up and saw a crowd of childish faces pressed against the window. Most Chinamen make friends with children. This one hated them and tried to drive them away. But as soon as he returned to his work, they were back at the window again, mischievously smiling down upon him. The naughty Mandarin uttered horrid words in the Manchu language and made fierce gestures, but this did no good at all. The children stayed as long as they pleased, and they came again the very next day as soon as school was over, and likewise the next day and the next. For they saw their presence at the window bothered the Chinaman, and were delighted accordingly. The following day, being Sunday, the children did not appear, but as the Mandarin, being heathen, worked in his little shop, a big butterfly flew in at the open door and fluttered about the room. The Mandarin closed the door and chased the butterfly until he caught it, when he pinned it against the wall by sticking two pins through its beautiful wings. This did not hurt the butterfly, there being no feeling in its wings, but it made him a safe prisoner. This butterfly was of large size, and its wings were exquisitely marked by gorgeous colors laid out in regular designs, like the stained-glass windows of a cathedral. The Mandarin now opened his wooden chest, and drew forth the great book of magic he had stolen from Hao Tsai. Turning the pages slowly, he came to a passage describing how to understand the language of butterflies. This he read carefully, and then mixed a magic formula in a tin cup, and drank it down with a wry face. Immediately thereafter, he spoke to the butterfly in its own language, saying, "Why did you enter this room?"
"I smelled beeswax," answered the butterfly. "Therefore, I thought I might find honey here."
"But you are my prisoner," said the Mandarin. "If I please, I can kill you, or leave you on the wall to starve to death."
"I expect that," replied the butterfly with a sigh. "But my race is short-lived anyway. It doesn't matter whether death comes sooner or later."
"Yet you like to live, do you not?" asked the Mandarin.
"Yes, life is pleasant and the world is beautiful. I do not seek death."
"Then," said the Mandarin, "I will give you life, a long and pleasant life, if you will promise to obey me for a time and carry out my instructions."
"How can a butterfly serve a man?" asked the creature in surprise.
"Usually they cannot," was the reply, "but I have a book of magic which teaches me strange things. Do you promise?"
"Oh yes, I promise," answered the butterfly, "for even as your slave I will get some enjoyment out of life, while should you kill me, that is the end of everything."
"Truly," said the Mandarin, "butterflies have no souls, and therefore cannot live again."
"But I have enjoyed 3 lives already," returned the butterfly with some pride. "I have been a caterpillar and a chrysalis before I became a butterfly. You were never anything but a Chinaman, although I admit your life is longer than mine."
"I will extend your life for many days if you will obey me," declared the Chinaman. "I can easily do so by means of my magic."
"Of course I will obey you," said the butterfly carelessly.
"Then listen. You know children, do you not? Boys and girls?"
"Yes, I know them. They chase me and try to catch me as you have done," replied the butterfly.
"And they mock me and jeer at me through the window," continued the Mandarin bitterly. "Therefore they are your enemies and mine. But with your aid and the help of the magic book, we shall have a fine revenge for their insults."
"I don't care much for revenge," said the butterfly. "They are but children, and 'tis natural they should wish to catch such a beautiful creature as I am."
"Nevertheless, I care, and you must obey me," retorted the Mandarin harshly. "I, at least, will have my revenge." Then he stuck a drop of molasses upon the wall beside the butterfly's head and said, "Eat that while I read my book and prepare my magic formula." So the butterfly feasted upon the molasses, and the Mandarin studied his book, after which he began to mix a magic compound in the tin cup. When the mixture was ready, he released the butterfly from the wall and said to it, "I command you to dip your 2 front feet into this magic compound, and then fly away until you meet a child. Fly close, whether it be a boy or a girl, and touch the child upon its forehead with your feet. Whosoever is thus touched, the book declares, will at once become a pig, and will remain such forever after.
then return to me and dip your legs afresh in the contents of this cup. So shall all my enemies, the children, become miserable swine, while no one will think of accusing me of the sorcery." "Very well. Since such is your command, I obey," said the butterfly. Then it dipped its front legs, which were the shortest of the six, into the contents of the tin cup, and flew out of the door, and away over the houses to the edge of the town. There it alighted in a flower garden, and soon forgot all about its mission to turn children into swine. In going from flower to flower it soon brushed the magic compound from its legs, so that when the sun began to set, and the butterfly finally remembered its master, the mandarin, it could not have injured a child had it tried. But it did not intend to try. "That horrid old Chinaman," it thought, "hates children and wishes to destroy them. But I rather like children myself, and shall not harm them. Of course, I must return to my master, for he is a magician, and would seek me out and kill me. But I can deceive him about this matter easily enough." When the butterfly flew in at the door of the mandarin's laundry, he asked eagerly, "Well, did you meet a child?" "I did," replied the butterfly calmly. "It was a pretty golden-haired girl, but now 'tis a grunting pig."
"Good, good, good," cried the mandarin, dancing joyfully about the room. "You shall have molasses for your supper, and tomorrow you must change two children into pigs."
The butterfly did not reply, but ate the molasses in silence. Having no soul, it had no conscience, and having no conscience, it was able to lie to the mandarin with great readiness and a certain amount of enjoyment. Next morning, by the mandarin's command, the butterfly dipped its legs in the mixture and flew away in search of children. When it came to the edge of the town, it noticed a pig in a sty, and alighting upon the rail of the sty, it looked down at the creature and thought, "If I could change a child into a pig by touching it with the magic compound, what could I change a pig into, I wonder?" Being curious to determine this fine point in sorcery, the butterfly fluttered down and touched its front feet to the pig's nose. Instantly the animal disappeared, and in its place was a shock-headed, dirty-looking boy, which sprang from the sty and ran down the road, uttering loud whoops.
"That's funny," said the butterfly to itself. "The mandarin would be very angry with me if he knew of this, for I have liberated one more of the creatures that bother him."
It fluttered along after the boy, who had paused to throw stones at a cat. But Pussy escaped by running up a tree, where thick branches protected her from the stones. Then the boy discovered a newly planted garden, and trampled upon the beds until the seeds were scattered far and wide, and the garden was ruined. Next he caught up a switch, and struck with it a young calf that stood quietly grazing in a field. The poor creature ran away with piteous bleats, and the boy laughed and followed after it, striking the frightened animal again and again. "Really," thought the butterfly, "I do not wonder the mandarin hates children, if they are all so cruel and wicked as this one." The calf having escaped him, the boy came back to the road, where he met two little girls on their way to school. One of them had a red apple in her hand, and the boy snatched it away and began eating it. The little girl commenced to cry, but her companion, more brave and sturdy, cried out, "You ought to be ashamed of yourself, you nasty boy!" At this, the boy reached out and slapped her pretty face, whereupon she also began to sob. Although possessed of neither soul nor conscience, the butterfly had a very tender heart, and now decided it could endure this boy no longer. "If I permitted him to exist," it reflected, "I should never forgive myself, for the monster would do nothing but evil from morning till night." So it flew directly into his face, and touched his forehead with its sticky front feet. The next instant the boy had disappeared, but a grunting pig ran swiftly up the road in the direction of its sty. The butterfly gave a sigh of relief. "This time I have indeed used the mandarin's magic upon a child," it whispered as it floated lazily upon the light breeze. "But since the child was originally a pig, I do not think I have any cause to reproach myself. The little girls were sweet and gentle, and I would not injure them to save my life. But were all boys like this transformed pig, I should not hesitate to carry out the mandarin's orders." Then it flew into a rosebush, where it remained comfortably until evening. At sundown, it returned to its master. "Have you changed two of them into pigs?" he asked at once. "I have," replied the butterfly. "One was a pretty black-eyed baby, and the other a freckled-faced, red-haired, barefooted new boy."
"Good, good, good!" screamed the mandarin in an ecstasy of delight. "Those are the ones who torment me the most. Change every new boy you meet into a pig."
"Very well," answered the butterfly, quietly, and ate its supper of molasses. Several days were passed by the butterfly in the same manner. It fluttered aimlessly about the flower gardens while the sun shone, and returned at night to the mandarin with false tales of turning children into swine. Sometimes it would be one child which was transformed, sometimes two, and occasionally three, but the mandarin always greeted the butterfly's report with intense delight, and gave him molasses for supper. One evening, however, the butterfly thought it might be well to vary the report, so that the mandarin might not grow suspicious, and when its master asked what child had been changed into a pig that day, the lying creature answered, "It was a Chinese boy, and when I touched him, he became a black pig." This angered the mandarin, who was in an especially cross mood. He spitefully snapped the butterfly with his finger, and nearly broke its beautiful wing, for he forgot that Chinese boys had once mocked him, and only remembered his hatred for American boys. The butterfly became very indignant at this abuse from the mandarin. It refused to eat its molasses, and sulked all the evening, for it had grown to hate the mandarin almost as much as the mandarin hated children. When morning came, it was still trembling with indignation, but the mandarin cried out, "Make haste, miserable slave, for today you must change four children into pigs, to make up for yesterday." The butterfly did not reply. His little black eyes were sparkling wickedly, and no sooner had he dipped his feet into the magic compound than he flew full in the mandarin's face, and touched him upon his ugly, flat forehead. Soon after, a gentleman came into the room for his laundry. The mandarin was not there, but running around the place was a repulsive, scrawny pig, which squealed most miserably. The butterfly flew away to a brook, and washed from its feet all traces of the magic compound. When night came, it slept in a rose bush. End of The Mandarin and the Butterfly. Recording by Matthew Reese, Davenport, Iowa. End of American Fairy Tales by L. Frank Baum.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.